Good evening, my name's Lane. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm nervous. I want to take a minute to welcome all the families in attendance tonight. I know some of y'all were here last month, and this is like a bonus round for me. And my mom's been here the last 2 months, and I want to acknowledge my mom and let you guys know that without her, I probably wouldn't be standing here today. And I mean that. So I'm going to cry too. All the families in attendance, you know, you guys, y'all saw it all in action. Y'all been there. You know, Dale says, you know, his dad told him one time, I was there, I saw it, and I was sober through the whole thing. I wasn't. So there's a line in the big book that says, passing all understanding is the patient's mother's have had with alcoholics. And it says, had this not been so, many of us alcoholics would have no homes and perhaps be dead today. And that's my truth for sure. You know, I was thinking a lot about what I was going to say when I got up here tonight. Actually, Marcia came into my office this week and she said, hey, I'm going to come over there. And I said, oh boy. You know. She walked into my office and she said, are you nervous? And I said, no, I'm not nervous. And I was like, yeah, I'm kind of nervous. And she said, you want to speak this Saturday? And of course, I mean, like, guys, this is like, I grew up playing football and sports and I'm an athlete. And there's like things that athletes that I always admired and wanted to be like. And then my athletic career ended. And I'm not going to touch on that a lot tonight, but my dreams vanished. Everything that I'd ever based my self-worth on was gone in the twist of a knee. And I lost hope. I lost purpose in life. I used to sleep with a football in sixth grade because I couldn't wait to get in the game on the field in seventh grade. And that's kind of what my recovery is like today. I can't wait to get up here behind this podium so I can tell you guys the good news that God's done in my life. The good things that happened as a result of working these steps and being honest and a man of integrity. And I stand before you today, a man that I'm really not supposed to be here. I've got a lot of experience that says that close. Why? Why me? Why am I still here? I don't know the answer to that other than I get an opportunity to do stuff like this from time to time and I let this power use me as a vessel. And I'm thrilled. I'm honored to be up here tonight. So thank you, Marcia. Jonathan, Jason's in the crowd. Greg, I got some of my heroes are here tonight. Blake's in the audience. She's the sparkle in my eye. I met her a couple years ago, and she means the world to me. So I really am. Words can't describe how grateful I am to see the people who took the time out of their night on a Saturday to come out here and hear me speak. And there's a lot of you, and I won't get into naming names because I'd leave somebody off, and I'm so self-centered that I would think you wouldn't like me. So I'm not going to go into that. But from the bottom of my heart, thank you guys for showing up tonight. And all that's been coming to me this week is that God's going to use me tonight. God's going to use me, and I'm going to be used to carry a message of hope, and I'm going to do my best to not use any language that's not acceptable. I'm going to talk in a way tonight that I hope that every mom in here would approve of, including my own. And I had to pray and ask God for that because I'm left to my own devices. I don't do very well. I've changed a lot, but not in that area. So guys, I guess when Marcia asked me to speak, I think it was a Tuesday or Wednesday, I don't know, but I was like, man, I'm ready to tell my story now. So I did, like four times driving in my car. People would drive by, and I'm like, I'm in the middle of it. And I'm like, this is going to be so good. And every time I get behind the podium, I don't remember any of that. So I'm going to let it fly tonight. So the first thing I want to tell you guys is, you know, there's a this place in particular is very special to me. The last time I stood at this podium, there wasn't quite this many people in here, and they didn't have vehicles. The ones that were in the crowd listening to me, they were all residents. And but anytime you get up behind this podium in this hall with this crowd and this spirit that moves in here, something special is happening. The man on the wall up there, I never got to meet him, but I know him. I've listened to his tapes, his CDs. I had to throw them away because I started stealing his experience and sharing in meetings about Mark Houston's 25 years sober, and he's saying, for me, it's not about alcohol anymore. It's about seeing how close I can get to God on a daily basis. And in about 6 months sober, I shared that. And in about 7 months sober, I was about ready to get drunk. So I said, I better get rid of these. And because I wasn't at on that level. I wasn't on that level. I hadn't progressed on the spiritual path to the point to where that man had, and I'm very grateful, and what an honor to be up here tonight in this hall. I never thought, you see, when I came here, I thought I was coming here, and I thought I was going to come here for 90 days and go home. Yeah. I'm still here. My sobriety date's March 25th, 2010, and we'll get into a little bit of that in a little while. But you know, so all you guys that are over here, and all you women that are like, I'm not staying more than 90. I've been here for over 3.5 years. I'm gonna make some guys over here really upset tonight, probably. You know, if I disturb somebody in here tonight, you might have needed to have been disturbed. Because I'm going to talk about alcoholism and how it's a fatal progressive illness that was absolutely coming from my jugular. And it was, and I believe today, guys, it still is. And that's why I have to stay active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have to keep my feet moving. And that's a blessing that I'm able to stand up here before you today. See, because I'm the guy who, I got it. Everything's okay, right? I'm fine. I don't even think about drinking anymore. You know? Until I'm drinking. So we're going to touch on a little bit of that tonight, and I hope to give you guys a clear picture of who I am, what my life was like, what happened, and what my life's like today. I grew up in Waxahachie, Texas. And yes, that's how you say it, Waxahachie. So if you've ever seen it spelled, everyone I know says Waxahachie. And no, not everybody where I'm from talks like I talk. everyone thinks like Waxahachie is like in the middle of absolutely nowhere because of the way I talk. And it's not. We've got, you know, I tell people, I'm like, we got a Buffalo Wild Wings. And if you have to tell people that... Hey, Marsha, here's a funny story. Marsha went a while back, and she was going to, I don't remember where she was going, but she walked up in Johnny Carino's, and she texted me, and she said, what in the world is happening in Waxahachie? And I said, well, why? And she said, I'm sitting in Johnny Carino's, and people are smoking cigarettes next to me. Good old Waxahachie. Anyways, guys, I grew up in Waxahachie, Texas. I was born, I'm 29 years old. I grew up in a wonderful family. I've got an older brother who I always wanted to be like and a younger sister who I always wanted her to look up to me. You know, here's the thing, right? My brother drinks alcohol normally. My dad drinks alcohol normally. My sister drinks alcohol normally. I don't know how many years ago, I'm 14, 15... Forgive me if I'm wrong, but my mom woke up one day and she said, I can't drink anymore because after 7 o'clock I can't pick my kids up. So she stopped. So everybody in my immediate family has been able to control, moderate, or stop. So you got to understand, right? I mean, the big book talks about it. Most men are unwilling to admit that they are bodily and mentally different from their fellows, right? I've been unwilling at this point to admit I'm an alcoholic because alcohol is so socially acceptable, and I've seen, like, you know, back in the day when my family would have parties and stuff, like, you know, their friends come over, and at 7 o'clock, hey, how y'all doing? And about 8, the music got a little louder, and at 9, the music was a little louder, and then people were smiling bigger, and laughs got louder, and it looked fun. I never in my life would have thought that my experience in the streets and with alcohol was going to be what it was. I grew up and I was raised in the family where everything was. I mean, my mom was, she was taking us to church. She was telling us that's not right. This is the way you need to act. And I was a pretty good kid growing up. I had the highest grade point average in Cornerstone Christian School from first to fifth grade. And a lot of people were proud of me. And then the book talks about this spiritual malady, and it talks about this feeling of irritable, restless, and discontent. And I can't. I think I lived in it for so long that I'm really not able to be like, yeah, I felt real different. I think maybe I always felt different. You know, and it wasn't like I felt empty, or because I was always the best, right? I made the highest grade point average. I was the best guy at kickball on the playground. You know, the prettiest girl in the class gave me a kiss on the cheek. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like I was in the background going, man, I just wish I could be like John. It wasn't like that. I was that guy. I can remember at an early age, my mom and dad, they took me to, and I don't know if this had something to do with some spiritual discontentment or what, but they walked me up to the Cornerstone Christian School on the first day of class, and there's a big cornfield next to the high school, right in between them. And I got up to that door, and I saw the principal come out, and he was welcoming all the kids, and I was gone. I took off chopping all the way out in the cornfield. I was like, I'm not going in there. And I don't know what that was about. I was afraid, though. Looking back, I was afraid. I don't want to go in that place, man. I'm not okay with that. My mom and them were like, "What do we do?" He'll come back. But I had my first drink of alcohol at the age of 13. I believe I was 13. Everybody was gone one day at the house, and we had a hot tub, and my parents had a liquor cabinet, and, you know, it looked like the music got louder at the party, so I thought, well, I'll give it a whirl. I made a screwdriver, vodka and orange juice, and there were signs that were saying I was alcoholic. I'm about to tell you why, because I poured me a drink, and I didn't just drink it. I went and sat in a hot tub with a straw, okay? Any of y'all that know anything about drinking alcohol and hot water and with the straw, it happens a little bit quicker. And I was on the phone with the girl, I think, and I was just drinking that drink, and I was like, I think I sound a little bit cooler. I think she's feeling me now. So I went and made another one, and I drank that one. And then guess what happened? I stopped. I didn't have another one. You know, I hear a lot of people talk about how when they put it in their system, they got, I want more. That was not my experience. I had two. I felt, man, I feel good. And then I shut it down. I don't know when the next time I picked up a drink of alcohol was, and I'm not gonna go into all that really tonight, but I am going to tell you that a certain point was reached where I lost the ability to control my drinking. And I don't think it was very many years after that. I was about 16 years of age, and I started. See, here's the deal. I'm a guy in seventh grade who said I'm never going to smoke marijuana. I promise you that. You know, I'm never going to drink and drive. I promise you that. And I broke all those promises, and it wasn't long after that. See, because I didn't know that something was driving me inside that I didn't feel. I just didn't. I don't know why. I thought it was a cool thing to do, right? There was no thought about, well, you better not do this now because you're going to be checking into Mark Houston Recovery in 2010. I didn't see that. I didn't see you better not do that now because you're going to get a DWI when you're 18 years of old, 18 years of age. You're going to miss your graduation. I didn't see that. You better do this because you're going to get pulled over in Houston, Texas several times and go to jail. I didn't see that. I was just trying to have a good time. Something happens to me when I put it in my system that's different than what happens when my brother puts it in his system. I want more. And I'm going to do anything to go get it. That's just the way it is. I continued after about the age of 16. I was drinking football and hanging out on the weekends was kind of what we did. And yes, we had field parties, Tracy. And we didn't call them pastures. We called them fields. And we went out in the fields on the weekends and turned the radios up loud and we got down. And that's just the way it happened. And so we started doing this kind of stuff, guys, and I'm having the time of my life. I'm going to be the first one to tell you, if drugs and alcohol treated me the way they did when I first started using them, I wouldn't be standing up here in front of you today. They stopped. It stopped working. It stopped working for me. I ended up getting in a series of events led me to getting a little bit too intoxicated on my the night of my senior year graduation. And I got arrested. Let me just tell you kind of the mindset and the master manipulator that I am. My brother graduates high school. He gets a brand new Honda CRV, right? My sister graduates high school. She gets a black Honda that my mom used to drive. Well, guess what I got? I got a brand new 2003 Lexus IS fresh off the lot. Because that's what I do. I know how to pull strings like that. I know how to make mom think, come on, Mom. And my dad's like, well, he's good at football, you know. He is going to go to University of Houston, and that's where my dad played. So I'm making everyone proud. Well, guess what a guy like me does with a nice, shiny gift like that? 6 days in, I'm going 120 miles an hour down a country road, drunk as can be on vodka and lemonade, and been drinking beer on a golf course all day. And this is a Thursday night, right? You're not supposed to be drinking like this on a Thursday at 18 years of age. And I'm listening to Linkin Park, for all y'all that know them. And I'm crawling in my skin. And I see this road, and I'm coming up, and there's a stop sign, guys. And I got to tell you, 120 miles an hour, that stop sign showed up a lot quicker than it normally did. And it was a T. My car swung around off the back end of a little drop-off, a cliff. I had a guy in the front seat, a buddy of mine, a girl in the back, and they said his cousin was in the car. But I think as soon as all that happened, he took off running, and my buddy hits his head on the front of the car, splits his nose open, and I look over and there's a white rock bottom creek and my car is hanging on the edge of it. And there's a telephone pole right there. That's one. That's just one. You know, and I look back at stuff like that and that's why I tell you guys, I don't know why I'm standing here in front of you today. I probably should not be here. That's one event that happened that was life-threatening. And not just mine. Theirs. So the cops show up, and guess whose fault it is? Theirs. Because they told me that I needed to leave this gentleman's house that I was at, and that I could not be at this house partying. I said, dude, you told me to leave. And now you're going to take me to jail? I can't stand cops at this point in my life. Because they do their job. Right, I found that out in the seats right over there inside that main house. So that's one example, right? So guess what happens? My parents, I get grounded at 18 years of age. Because I can't stand on my own two feet. I'm still under the control of my family. And I know, guys. See, let me make something clear to y'all. All you guys in here who grew up and you worked hard and you went out and made your money and you were using and drinking and getting by, that's not my experience. I'm a spoiled punk who does nothing but gets high, drinks my dad's beer out of the back refrigerator at 2 in the morning and pisses him off. That's as close as I'm going to get to using a cuss word tonight. But guess what? I'm a grown man. That's what I tell people. I'm a grown man. One day it dawned on me, grown men pay their bills and are respectful and they treat their friends with respect. They don't act the way I acted. So that was a there's a story in the big book that it talks about the jaywalker. And one time a guy had me when I got out of benchmark. He said, I want you to go in the jaywalker story and I want you to be the jaywalker. I want you to list all the experiences you had that were red flags. And I started listing these experiences and I was like, you have got to be kidding me, man. I didn't see that. I couldn't see that this was not okay. I blew through that one. Another one? You got to be kidding me, right? Because what it talks about is it talks about this guy that he skips out in front of fast-moving vehicles and he gets hit and he breaks his arm. And then he says, well, dust himself off, and 2 days later he skips in front of another one and breaks his back. Gets out of the hospital and is trying everything he can to get this jaywalking idea out of his head. And the day he gets out of the hospital, guess what he did? He does it again. That's my experience with drugs and alcohol. That's my experience. That's the way I am. Without defense against the first drink, I will put it in my system again and again and again, regardless of the consequences. You cannot scare a guy like me into getting sober. I've been scared all my life. That drives me to put it back in my system. I went to the University of Houston. I played football there. I was a walk-on for University of Houston, and I was running down the field one day with a guy, huge tight end. He turned me out, and my left knee popped. And Bill talks about the stock market had crashed and gone to hell, and so had he. And that's my stock market. That's when all bets were off. I had lost everything I knew. That was who I was. That's how people knew me. That's how I gained respect. That's how I got girls to like me. That's how I felt like my dad. That's why my dad valued me. I felt like my brother looked up to me because I was playing football, and I'm on the sidelines against Rice suited up, and I'm starting to hit people, and it's over, just like that. I'll never forget walking out of that locker room one day. You know, you see all these movies, right, about these guys and their sports career ends, and you're just like, man, that's sad. I lived it. I experienced it. I walked out of this locker room one day, and I said, once I walk out this door, my football career, as I know it, is over. And man, you talk about, this is a nightmare. And so I ended up doing what all good drug addicts do, and that's going to school, showing up well for the first couple classes, and then not doing well. I got my transcript a while back because I'm looking into, you know, I'm doing some stuff now, and I need my transcripts today. Thank you, God. And I see these things, and I'm looking back at my grades, and I'm like, W. And I'm like, I tell everybody that means I did well. Y'all know what that means. Medical withdrawal. Yeah. So I moved back to Waxahachie because I can't pull it off at school. When I was at U of H, though, I could really start feeling this spiritual malady. I was just discontent and restless, and I felt like I wasn't good enough, and people were kind of looking at me crazy in class, and they know I'm not smart. That's what my mind's telling me. They're like, well, he's an idiot, right? And all I'm doing is going into class, and I'm like, well, man, all I have to do is sit by the guy with the pink test. I need a pink test, and he needs a pink test. But they started making blue and yellow, pink and green tests, and they pass them out accordingly, and I'm not next to a guy with the pink test, so I go home. Right? That's just the way it looks. But I started, you know what I did? Because I wasn't able to go to class because my anxiety, and I guess I started smoking a lot of marijuana and I started taking Xanax. And anybody that knows about that, I'm in biology raising my hand. I'm like, hey, I know the answer. Well, I have a question, actually. I don't know the answer. But is it... And I would be taking notes, and I'm like, yes, I'm so proud of myself, man. I'm finally getting back in the game. And anybody that takes Xanax knows what that does to you. I get home and I go to sleep and I wake up and I'm like, what does that say? What does that mean? I don't remember doing this, but I showed up, right? So guys, it just didn't work out, man. I my family, I had my door kicked in because I mean, I'm just not the guy you want your kid hanging out with. I got my door kicked in because I've got 2 pounds of marijuana in the refrigerator upstairs. And I mean, I was not raised that way. I was not raised that way. So I went back to Waxahachie, and when I got back to Waxahachie, everything looked good, right? You go back, and you're like, all right, fresh start. Here we go. You know, we're going to make this work. And I go up there, and slowly but surely, guess what starts happening? The same thing that was happening. The same thing that was happening. I take a drink of beer. That's what you hear after about four beers. And that's me at the cocaine house. That's just the way I'm wired. I used to drink beer in front of people, and they would be sitting. I was driving home from Arlington one day, and I'm sitting in the I'm driving my truck, by the way, so you know, yes, I was drinking a beer while I was driving. And my buddy looks over at me, and he's like staring at me like this, and I'm like, "What are you looking at, man?" And he's like, "Watching the beer can touching my lips." And I'm like, "Dude, quit looking at me like that." And I took a drink, and he goes, "Ooh-wee." He's like, "You're going to the dope man tonight, aren't you?" I said, "No, I'm not." Guess what happened? I went to the dope man that night. I don't understand it. I don't understand it. I just want to drink beer like my dad and my brother and go home and get up and go to work and do all that stuff and be a normal guy and have a family. But I can't. And I can't accept that at this point in my life. I had not reached the level of bankruptcy internally at that point in my life. I'm gonna try everything I know. I'm gonna beat the game. I'm gonna beat the game. And I get there, guys. I can't beat the game. The game's no longer a game. What it starts looking like is I find myself in neighborhoods that I'm not supposed to be in. That's the kind of man that's standing before you tonight. I'll go to any lengths to go and get that. I will. I'm the guy who picks up the guy walking down the road with one shoe on that's, you know who he is. Really? That's what it's come down to? You bet. So a series of events, this book talks about a phenomenon of craving that at once becomes paramount. And so important events are not met. When I put a drug in my system or a drink in my system, I don't stop. I don't stop. And I'm blowing through everybody I got to get to it. And that's just the way it is. I've had some experiences with my family that... you know, here's what it looks like, all right? I'm just going to give you guys a little peek at this. I go out on the bad side of town. Buddy's selling some marijuana. I'm sitting in the passenger seat. Guy snatches the bag, runs, takes off. I chase him down because I'm going to be the hero, right? And I did. I chased him down, and we squared up, and guess what he did? He stabbed me three times. He hit me right here. He hit me in my back, and he hit me in my collarbone. And I'm walking down the middle of the street. I feel like I'm in a movie. I've got a knife in my hand and I'm bleeding everywhere. And I think, you know what most normal people would think? You're going to die. You know what my egotistical alcoholic mind told me? Can't nobody kill me. And guys, I say that, and the people that are laughing get it. I see the family's faces because you know what I'm talking about. I wake up and I'm in the hospital and they're stitching me up, and I look up and there's my brother and there's my mom, and they're crying, and they think possibly could lose their son and their brother. You know what the next thought I had was? I wonder what kind of pills they're going to give me. That's the nature of the beast of alcoholism and addiction. I had guns pulled. I'm walking down the street in Houston, Texas. A guy opens fire, and I've taken a couple of substances into my system. And the guy that's shooting, his buddy's with him, and I got to get to him. And he's shooting at the party, and I'm ducking and dodging to go back behind him. Insanity. Crazy. And I stand up here before you tonight, and I tell you that I don't speak of these things because I'm proud of them. I speak of these things to let you know that when I got here, I didn't think God was working in my life. I didn't think God had been in my life. God abandoned me. And I get here and I start hearing these people say, "Is it possible that God was with you in the midst of your addiction? Is it possible?" And it's not cold up here, but I got goosebumps right now. And I believe that's how the Spirit moves. And the Spirit was moving like that, guys. When I checked in here March 20th, I got arrested March. See, I didn't... throw up my white flag willingly. I got arrested one night. God reached out and grabbed me one night, March 24, 2010. I was driving under the influence. I'd been up for, I don't know, got six beers, marijuana, Xanax. I didn't know I had the Xanax. You know how that works, right? And I had cocaine on me, and this guy pulls me over, and he says, "Mr. Russ, have you been drinking?" And I won't even tell y'all why he pulled me over. We don't have enough time to do that tonight. But he says, "Mr. Russ, have you been drinking?" And my first thought is like, "Are you kidding me? Do you see me? I'm pitiful. Look at me, man. I got a picture in my wallet. I'll show anybody in here." He didn't even have to ask that question. I look like I've been beat up, rolled around in a bunch of mud, and stuck behind the driver's seat. And I thought I was good looking at the time. So this guy takes me in, he puts me in handcuffs, and you know what he told me? He said, you tell me where you got this tonight, and I'll let you go. And so here's my deal for all of us that come in here, and we're all wired hard, I'm not telling on anybody. You really want to know? See, that's the way I am. I don't care about you. If it'll save my face, I'm down to tell on you in a heartbeat. Because I talk about we're boys and this and that. We're not boys. I got one boy, and it's the substances. That's the only thing I care about. Guy took me to jail that night, and that phenomenon of craving was paramount to the point to where, see, I've been to jail seven times already at this point in my life. I know what they do when they take you into a jail. You are not going to get in that jail cell with any substances on you. But I might. Right? So this guy pulls me out, and I hide this cocaine bag in my shoe because I'm going to outsmart the police. And he finds the bar of Xanax and the marijuana. I see, I'm so out of it, I have two bags of weed in my pocket. I don't even know they're in my pocket. He's like, "You got anything on you?" I said, "No, sir." "What's that?" "Oh, my God." So immediately, I'm like, "Well, good, it's just that. This is the decoy, right? He won't know about the rest." This guy arrests me and takes me into jail, and I'm like, "I got this stuff hiding, so it's down in the toe of my shoe. It's in my sock." And my plan is to get in this jail cell. But see, guys, because I can't imagine being separated from this last batch of cocaine that I have for any length of time. I'm going down with it. And I got in that place, and he said, "Take your sock off." And I took it off, and I was like, "All I have to do is hold these three baggies and put..." And I did it, and they fell. He was like, "Uh-oh." That's exactly what he said. And I promise you guys, the level of anger in me at that point was absolute. It was through the roof. Because now I'm going in, "You got me, and you got that." And I can't imagine being in a cell. Anybody that's ever done cocaine, you wouldn't want to do it in a jail cell. Everybody's asleep. You wouldn't have anybody to talk to, and the walls are tight. But I wanted to do it, guys, because that's like my oxygen. That's what I need to be okay. But I'm not really okay. So I didn't see God's hand in this, right? I'm there, and this happens, and I'm like, "Ugh!" And he didn't see one, so I picked it up and I put it in the waistband of my boxers, and I'm like, "You got me," you know. And when I get arrested and I know I'm going down, I become like the guy that you don't want to deal with anymore. Like, I'm cool until you put me in handcuffs or you say it's over, and then I turn into a different guy. And so I'm like, "Oh no, you caught me, man," you know. And I'm like, "Well, good, I got one more." And I turned around and it fell, and I was so I went to jail. And you know, guys, I had the Xanax, the marijuana, and then they found that. And guess what happened? That raised my bond up from $2,000 to $22,000 because I had controlled substance on county grounds or whatever it is. Somebody in here knows what I'm talking about, but you can't do that. And you know what? At that point, I thought my life was over. I thought that was it. I'm done. There's no more. There's nothing left for me. This is it. And little did I know, that was the beginning of it. That was the beginning of my life. See, here's what happened. I got in that jail, and at the time, I might have been worth $200 to a couple people still in Mark's Hatchie. But whenever they slammed that $22,000 on me, I'm not worth $2,200 to anybody. And my mom got on the phone with some people in the Hill Country, and they got on the phone with some people down here at Mark Houston, and Patrick, and Patrick said, "Oh, no, do not get him out." And boy, I tell you, if I could have spoken to Patrick at that point, I would have gave him a piece of my mind. But, you know, see, that's the thing. It goes against everything that a family might think, right? Well, let's get him out, and we'll get him help, and we'll get his life back on track, and everything will be great. But they let me sit in there, and they let me marinate. And then about 3 days in there, I'm crawling out of my skin. See, because now I know what this spiritual malady feels like. It is all over me. I'm sitting in there, and I'm going crazy. I pick up the phone, and I called my mom, and I made a phone call at the time that I regretted. I told my mom, I said, "Come get me out of jail." She said, "I'm not coming to get you." I said, "What do you mean you're not coming to get me?" Because 7 times prior, they had come and picked me up, right? She said, "I'm not coming." And I said, "Oh, really? Well, if you don't come and pick me up," I said, "I'll never call you my mother again." Crushed her, right? I didn't think twice about it. That's how sick I was. That's not the kind of man I am. And you know what my mom did? She saved my life. She said, "Well, I'm sorry if that's how you feel, then that's how it's going to have to be, but I refuse to continue to watch you ruin your life and the rest of our families." And she hung the phone up on me. And that was the day that I knew it was over. I knew it was over. I knew all my resources and all my mom I love. I knew it was over. And it was time to do something. And so I called them back a couple days later, and they said, "There's a place in Manor, Texas." See, because I'm going back to the place I went first. Here's the way that an addict thinks, right? I'm not going to a 90-day facility that's gender specific, where you need work boots and you got to be out of bed and you got to cook your own meals and you work out with a personal trainer. It's, man, I'm not doing that. I'm going back to the place I went, because the first time I went, I was in the collegiate program. It was 45 days. This time, I'm going to the adult program. It's only 30. They said, "You don't have the option. Your only option is Mark Houston Recovery Center, and this is what it looks like." And I said, "I'll call you back." You guys are sitting in here tonight, and there's a lot of stuff I'm saying. It's funny now, but at the time, I mean, I'm a sick individual. You know, I'm sick. I'm not thinking right. My thinking is a little skewed. Full flight from reality. Okay? So I get to this place, and I show up, and I get out, and I'm like, "Man, I am excited to be here, man." Because, you know, let me tell you something. This place right here, I don't care what your loved ones tell you on the phone, is way better than Ellis County Jail. You got real pillows, salt and pepper. See, these are the kind of things that I'm grateful for when I get here, but guess what happens 6 days later? I'm not grateful anymore. My dad told me a while back when I got sober, he said, "You know what, when you come to Benchmark, you get a little discount if you pay for the 90 days up front." He said, "I didn't believe you'd stay. I only paid month for month. Because then no one could trust me. I was a flight risk. My family's telling me, like, we're scared of you. We don't want to be around you." I don't understand what y'all are talking about. I think I'm doing just fine. They told me, they said, "If you continue to get high and drunk, then you're not going to be able to be around us anymore." And you know what the disease of addiction did to me at that point? See y'all later. That's not who I am. That's not who I am, y'all. I've got a big heart, and I'm a good man, and God lives and resides within me today. And He did when I was a kid, too. But the disease of addiction completely grabbed me and transformed every part about my life, and it made me into an absolute monster. And I'm not proud of that man anymore, but I guess what? We talk about him pretty often. Because the book talks about my dark past is my greatest asset. I get to share that with your loved ones all the time, because they need to hear that somebody's been where they've been. They need to hear that they've looked their mom in the eye and told her, "Mom, I can't be around you anymore. Mom, I need money. Mom, go to the bathroom so I can get in your purse. Push my grandmother out of the way to get to my truck." They need to hear that. And although it's probably not very comforting for some of y'all to revisit that spot, that's what we're up against. That's what we're up against here. And when y'all, you know, it blows my mind when I'm at work here and there's people that I talk to, and I tell families all the time, you're not a bad parent. You were doing the best you could. You just didn't know any better. My mom did the best she could. She gave everything she had. My dad gave everything he had. But you can't love a guy out of addiction. You can't give a guy things to get him out of addiction. The only thing that pulled me out of my addiction was some men here at Mark Houston Recovery Center that told me the truth. And they invited me to look at my experience. They invited me to say, when you put something in your body, do you react different? Is there an overwhelming desire for more? Well, you bet. The only thing I do after I take one is take another, right? How about when you stop? Can you stay stopped? Come on, man, I'm here, right? But the book talks about that I've lost the power to choose whether or not I'll drink again. I started looking at that, and that was hard. I didn't really understand that. See, I got the part when I put it in my system, I go. I got that. I'm like a thoroughbred. I'm off to the races. But sober, why is it that my mind tells me that things will be different? Why is it that my mind tells me cocaine's the problem and Keystone Light's not? Why is it? And I started looking at that kind of stuff. Something happened to me while I was on this property that completely changed the way that I looked at life. There was a desire to live that came back to me sitting in this room one night, 6 days sober, right here over here by Tracy in this circle at an in-house meeting. And these guys were sharing about how God was doing for them, what they couldn't do for themselves. And I'm like, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to hear that. I've been here and done this and tried this. It don't work. And it got to me and they said, do you want to share? And I said, yeah, I'll share. So I'm ready to go. I can't stay here anymore. And you know what? I thank God to this day, man, because there was about 20 guys in this room. Every one of them circled up around me after this meeting. And one of them took me out the front porch on that main house and he set me down. And he was 18 years old at the time. And he walked me through it. He talked me through it. And I made it just a little bit longer. Just a little bit longer. And then guess what happened? I woke up one morning, and y'all know, some of y'all know this part. I'm walking around on this property and I'm defiant. I'm outwardly compliant and inwardly defiant. I guess, sir, hey, how you doing? Glad to be here. I can't stand you. And guys, this is how small it was for me. And I hope everybody in this room hears me. I was walking out of the main south bedroom one day. And I knew the code of conduct here at Benchmark said when you leave the rooms that all lights need to be turned off and fans need to be off. And I'm walking out of the room and I'm like, the light's on. I didn't turn the light on. I'm not turning the light off. And I didn't really say it like that. I told y'all I'm not going to use any cuss words tonight. And I took about 2 steps out of that room. I said, I'm not turning the light off. To myself. I'm not doing that. And something, an amazing thing happened. Just turn the light off. And I turned around and turned that switch off and that started a spiritual journey for me. That's it. It's funny, isn't it? A light switch off. Normally it's on. Everything in the spiritual world is backwards. My light switch went off and I finally arrived. I started doing some stuff here at this facility and man, I can tell you, man, something happened in me here that I will forever in my life be grateful for because I got real serious about recovery. I got real serious about recovery. I started believing y'all when y'all told me that if I wasn't honest, step one didn't mean that I was gonna that I couldn't drink or use again. It meant I'm using and drinking again. That's what it meant. It didn't mean that I'm powerless. That means it's coming. Woo-wee, I'm so grateful for that, man. You can't manufacture that. I can't give that to you. That happened to me in this facility, and I started moving my feet. And things started changing. You know what? Recovery is a real weird deal. It happens. You start doing things that you've never done, and guess what? Things start happening that have never happened. Wow. Crazy, isn't it? So I left this place, and man, I was on fire. I walked out of here, and a couple weeks later, I guess it was about a month and a half, 2 months. I came out here for a Saturday night speaker meeting and I was walking down that driveway right there. And a guy walked up to me and said, hey, you want to work at Mark Houston? You want to work here? I'm like, excuse me? He said, "Yeah, we'd like to hire you." What? You bet. I've been working here for over 3 years now, and I get to see a lot of miracles happen at this place. You know, I won't get into any more about, you know, what that was like, but I do want to say that at 7 months sober, I was sitting in my apartment, and guys, I'm sponsoring people. I sat down with a guy at Austin Recovery, and he said, "Hey man, I was buying drugs from a dealer in Houston, Texas, and a guy put a pistol to my head and he robbed me and stole my car." Boom! I'm like, that's what happened to me on Ann Arbor Avenue in Dallas. A guy threw a gun on my head, stole my vehicle, and I never understood why. And I got to look at that guy and I said, "Guess what, buddy? That same thing happened to me." And we connected. We connected. And man, this is a... I just wish that everybody in this room tonight, my hope is that y'all can touch what I've touched. And that, and my, you know, God willing, I'm not going to stop doing this because I've seen some things. There's men that go to school for a long time and become doctors and perform open heart surgeries and families reunite in the waiting room and he's going to be great and this and that. I didn't go to school. I just did a bunch of stuff that a guy shouldn't be doing. And God reached down and grabbed me and said, "Come on, Lane, I got work for you to do. You're going to go with me and you're going to submit to my will, whether you like it or not, and you're going to have to make some decisions that are uncomfortable, and you're going to have to be focused on building character over comfort, and you're going to have to be honest and look people in the eye and tell them that you stole stuff from them. But I'm going to take care of you." And man, I'm going to tell you what, God is not a liar. To this day, man, my life is unbelievable. I've been thinking this week just about how grateful I am for the things that have been given to me. You know, it's hard to take credit for something that you can't explain. You know what I mean? An egotistical, arrogant, alcoholic, and addict like myself, boy, I am quick to be like, "Yes, sir, I did that. I haven't done anything, guys. I haven't done anything. I've been consistent in my recovery. I haven't done it perfect. I used to think you had to do it perfect. I've done a lot of things in my life that are far from perfect. And one thing that I've been able to do over the last probably 6 months of my life has been able to go, you're doing a little bit better than you used to in that area, and not beat myself up so bad." I got people in my life like Blake. I'm like, "Golly, I can't believe I'm thinking like this." She's like, "Chill out." Call my mom. Hey, I'm going to tell you something too. When you first get into recovery, my mom was like, "Well, you know, just keep on. I'm proud of you." The last few times I've talked to her, she's like, "Well, it sounds like you're being pretty selfish." And I'm like, I get to sponsor other men today. I've got a couple sponsees here tonight. A few of them, actually. I got a guy in the front row here. This is a miracle. If he doesn't take any drugs or drink anything tonight, he'll have 6 months sober tomorrow. And that's a miracle. So. My family's back in my life. I've got two nieces that... the day I left for treatment, my family wouldn't take me home. They wouldn't. They didn't trust me. They took me to my brother's house and said, "You can go in there and take a shower." And when I came out of that house, I saw my niece riding a bicycle around the driveway. And it's a pink bicycle with training wheels on it. And she said, "Where's Uncle Lane going?" And all I could say was, "I'm going to work and I'll be back." And that's exactly what I did. I came down here to Maynard, Texas. My address was 11503 for 90 days, and I got busy. And I did work that was put in front of me, and I helped people when I wasn't really... I didn't know if I was capable. But I got down and I sat knee to knee with some guys and I took them through this book and I started asking them questions. And you know what? That's what I did today. I got up this morning and went to a meeting at 8:30 in the morning and met a new guy. And Jonathan asked me what I did today and I said, I did the same thing I did yesterday. I got up, went to a meeting, met with the sponsee, had some good Mexican food for breakfast with him, talked about the big book a little bit, asked him what he was willing to start doing, went for a jog with Blake, went home, took a nap, sat quiet in meditation for 20 minutes, put on some sharp clothes that I finally had the money to go and buy, and I get to come out here and hang out with a bunch of people who, you know, when I pulled up on this property tonight, My heart just started beating because I knew that God was going to use me tonight. I knew that God was going to use me. I don't know if I've been able to bring anything to everybody in this room, and that's what a self-centered guy like me thinks they can do. But I guarantee you there's a couple in here who've heard something I've said tonight. And that's my job. I went out there on this little hill right here before all this started, and it's kind of muddy and there's rocks because Benchmark's doing big things with the pool and stuff like that. But I walked through this mud and I went out there to this spot where I sat when I first got here at about 8 days, 9 days sober, and I cut a deal with God. I said, God, I can't do this anymore, man. I need help. And I need you to come into my life. If you're out there, I need you to come into my life and I need your help. If you'll pull me out of this dark spot I'm in, I'll do your work for the rest of my days. And I went and visited that spot right before I came up here tonight. And I told God, I said, boy, we're in a little different boat today, God. We're in a little different boat now. See, because guys, I used to sit in this hall when I got out of here and I thought that I wanted an award, you know, for the Alumni of the Year award. And Jason started talking about, well, this guy got here and boy, he was serious, committed. And I'm like, man, what am I going to say when I get up there? It wasn't me. And then a couple years later, I'm up here giving an award. I told my story from this podium when I left this facility, and now a few years down the road, I'm telling my story to families and residents, my mom, my girlfriend, Marcia, Jonathan, all these people, man. There's so many special people in my life today. Wow. Who would have thought? I don't deserve this. This is all a gift from God, and I'm real, real clear about that, man. I made that commitment, and to this day, I've tried to live up to that commitment. And when I get scared and I get tired and I feel like giving up, there's that part of me right before it happens where I'm like, man, I'm not going to make it. God shows up. I get there right at the end of my rope and I'm like, this is it. I'm going to Chevron to get a 12-pack. And then God shows up. That's my experience. That's the way it looks. And it's available, I believe, to anybody in this room tonight. I don't care if you're an alcoholic or not. I believe God wants a personal relationship with every man and woman that walks this earth. I believe that. I'm going to close by saying this. There's a line in this book that... if you read this book and you get in the back end of it, you start seeing things that you're like, ooh, I didn't know that was in there. Maybe you should read it a little bit more, Lane. Right? I found this the other day, and this is kind of the man that I think God would have me be. It says that he should not be made a favorite. The right kind of man, the kind who recovers, will not want this sort of thing. He will not impose. Far from it. He will work like the devil and thank you till his dying day. And I hope and pray that that'll continue to be my experience. Thank you, guys.